dough. I'm living every day like a hustle. Another juggle, another day, another struggle. I don't wanna live no more. Sometimes I hear death knocking at my front door. I'm living every day like a hustle. Another juggle, another day, another struggle. I don't wanna live no more. Sometimes I hear death knocking at my front door. I'm living every day like a hustle. Another juggle, another day, another struggle. I don't wanna live no more. Sometimes I hear death knocking at my front door. I'm living every day like a hustle. Another to juggle, another day, another struggle.
Ride, Mafia, ride.
Hi friends, this is the information you've been waiting for. WBAI Latin Music Benefit Fundraiser will be held on April 1st at SOB's. 204 Varick Street in downtown Manhattan, and will be featuring the music of the Mambo Legends, formerly the Tito Puente Orchestra, with vocalist Cita Rodriguez. Also myself, Chico Alvarez, I'll be performing with Conjunto Sabor,
Los Hermanos de León, featuring Pete Pagan on vocals,
and the SOB debut of Nahibe La Gitana and Orquesta Tribu. Doors open at 6 p.m. until 11. A $25 donation will go straight to WBAI. Tickets go on sale February 8th, available online at WBAI.org or SOB's upcoming events website. Support Latin music shows New World Gallery and Con Sabor Latino every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 6 p.m. on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM or WBAI.org.
Hi, my name is Zheng Hua Song. I often have my radio turned to 99.5 FM WBAI. When I travel to Seoul, Korea, I listen on the web at WBAI.org. 안녕하세요. 제 이름은 송정화입니다. 저는 99.5 FM WBAI 라디오를 즐겨 듣습니다. 한국 서울에 가면은 저는 WBAI 라디오를 홈페이지 WBAI.org에서 듣습니다.
The Black Lives Matter movement is not only a political phenomenon, but a cultural one. In the February issue of The Independent, a group of six black writers wrote first-person pieces about why they love being black. Three of those writers, Nicholas Powers, Jamar Wakefield, and Brittany Williams, will join Lady Dragonfly in a conversation about their own experiences of learning to love their culture and themselves despite the deep-seated societal hostility to blackness grounded in 400 years of white supremacy. This event will happen on Thursday, March 17th at 7 p.m. at the Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Streets in the Borough Hill section of Brooklyn. For more information, go to independentwithay.org. That's independent.org.
You're my earth. Good morning. You're tuned to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight with Catherine Davis and Paulette Spencer. On tonight's program, we're going to be sharing a program that actually took place last year in 2015, in which we had a very interesting conversation with you, our listeners. Also, on today's program, we're going to be sharing a program by Paulette Spencer created for International Working Women's Day, and we hope you do enjoy that. We've just completed our fund drive, and I want to thank everyone who made a pledge to WBAI, and we're taking a bit of a break today, but we will be back next week, and we will open our phone lines and engage in a conversation with you. But be mindful, on today's program, we are not taking live calls because it's a rebroadcast, but I felt that this conversation was so interesting, certainly to me, and I hope to you as well, and I do hope you enjoy this morning's presentation of Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. Stay tuned and take good care. We'll be right back. Tuned to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis, and I am very, very pleased and happy to be with you this afternoon. We're listening to Sinead O'Connor from her, well, I'm not sure of the CD, but the song is called Old Babies. And it really does speak to the innocence, I feel, that we are born into when we come into this life, into this world. We kind of come in as beings that are entirely dependent on our parents and our society to show us the way of existence on earth, the way of being within a culture, within a society. And in many ways, it is that which existed on earth before us that helps to form who we are as beings, that creates for us a place in the world, a place within our own awareness of who and what we are. So in many ways, who we are is in some fashion a construct of something that came before. And I think what happens as we grow from small babies into young adults, teens and young adults, we start to challenge that preconceived idea of who we are. And we start to create for ourselves the kind of person we're going to be on the earth. And I can remember as I was growing up, I grew up during which I consider to be a very special, wonderful time. I'm sure all people feel that about the time that they made that transitional between the stages of child to teen to young adult. But in some ways, I felt a real reflection and affirmation in the world outside of me because I saw that there was great numbers of people who were beginning to say that there was something amiss in the world that we were living in. And people were beginning to question the established religions and seeking out the spirituality. Really, I think it just needed to be different. But a lot of people ended up in the East looking at the various teachings of India and Tibet and Africa. And also I think that people began to question the politics of our times and the decisions to engage in wars. And the war that overtook my particular youth in history, in the stages of history, was the Vietnam War. And I can certainly remember while still in junior high school and high school, being involved and interested in stopping the war in Vietnam, not understanding what it was all about. And it was interesting because I was really just becoming aware of politics and becoming aware of all that was happening in the world. And what had been for me kind of a stale story I read in a history book about an old war, World War I, World War II, Korean War. We hear about these things, but they don't feel real, certainly not in my mind as a young child and young adult. But when the Vietnam War came upon the scene, it became very present in my awareness, and I could really see the horror of war and conflict in an everyday occurrence, because at the time, the media was a much freer, in a much freer state. And you could actually turn on the news at night and see actual happenings taking place in Vietnam during the war. You would see people being exploded and, you know, the aftermath of the poor soldiers who were being carried out of the battlefield, and it made it very, very vibrant and frightful. And I remember at that time, I think I was probably still in junior high school, my older brother was of the age of the draft. And I remember being very afraid that he would be drafted and end up as one of these wounded people that I saw on the TV every night. So I felt even more energized to get involved in the anti-war movement, even though from the perspective of some, I was still quite young. Though truthfully, I see young people now out protesting violence at a much younger age than I was. Parents are bringing their children out with them. So I really had this awareness of what violence is, and I was it was kind of burnt into my system that this was a real horror on the scene of human existence. So that kind of initiated me, and probably the young people of that generation of the, I would say, the late 60s to the early 80s, was a generation of people that were engaged in a rejection of the social mores of the day, who wanted to live in a world that was free, that wanted to have peace, not war, you know, flower children, free love, and all of these slogans and activities, behaviors came into being. And people really began to challenge the choices that were made by our overall society. And I think a lot of this culminated in the resignation of President Nixon. And at that time, I remember feeling quite vindicated, thinking that the world was finally going to change. And I think a lot of young people of those days, perhaps young and old, believed that things were really going to change from that point on. But what occurred was a fluctuation that took humanity into perhaps an even lower state of being, where the openness of the media was eroded so that one could never truly get the whole story of anything that was going on in the world. And the media became sort of a ad hoc member or associate of the very forces that were working to take back control of the world, and really the world can be thought of as the consciousness of humanity. And in truth, I'm speaking primarily as a person growing up in the United States. I'm sure there were similar things going on in other countries, maybe a little different, but people were of an age of transforming the world, and then that desire and that belief slipped away. And part of that, perhaps, was by the overindulgence of, and the immaturity, I think, of those of us who believed that things would change as a consequence of the events. And indeed they may have, had there not been these other forces working towards control. And I found myself, and I would say much of my generation, falling into a sense of confusion, and that led to a sense of hopelessness and despair for many. And people began to filter back into their everyday lives, accepting what is, you know, just the way it is. Life goes on, and, you know, we thought we could change the world, but no, the world is changing us. And I think for a good time, through the 80s, the me generation, young people were growing up and jumping into the economic scene and looking towards taking care of themselves, their family, making sure that I'm looking out for number one, that I have the resources that I need, my family has the resources that we need. And there wasn't as much of a general concern. And there became a sense of judgment that was imbued within the society, and you can see a lot of that in the media as well, of judging the poor, judging the ones who don't have as being somehow lacking within themselves and really not the responsibility of the rest of us. So we grew through these years creating a massive, gnarly ugliness within the world by those beings of consciousness falling into, I would say, a quietness, a resignation, and those new beings on the earth sort of taking up the gauntlet of wealth and abundance, and in a way that I don't want to say was selfish, but maybe with a lack of consciousness of the whole, the need of the whole culture, the whole society of all beings. And this persisted for a time, and then we had a brief bit of sunshine with the Occupy movement most recently, I think, where young people more closely matched how I remember engaging in the world during my youth, where we were called to challenge the status quo. And what was really most beautiful about the Occupy movement is that it was expansive, it was global. And we're now living in the aftermath of, once again, the controlling forces pulling down the most outer manifestation of those movements so that people could not continue to put their bodies on the line. But I believe that this movement towards the light, towards making humanity lighter, is growing, it's expanding, and we can all feel it within ourselves, and we can feel it in how we engage with each other and with the world, and in how we deal with the challenges and conflicts in our life. And what I would really like to talk about today is how we are expressing this enlightening that of our spirit, of our soul, this unification of our being, and how we're translating that into the transformation that is occurring in the world in which we live. Because the only way to truly make this an expansive transformation is by not giving up into feelings of despair as we did in the 70s, early 80s, but to fine-tune and understand the magnitude of the power we have as light beings within a world that has density and confusion, and how we can interpret that light into the world as a tool of transformation to really get to the end game where the darkness is being overcome on a level that can transform. And it's difficult because many of the beings who are engaged in creating the horrors on the earth have so squeezed off or through other means been shadowed, squeezed off from their own inner light, it's very difficult to reach these beings who are engaged in war behaviors and terror behaviors, be they deemed as terrorist or be it coming from the sanction of the state in which we live, various states across the world. But as workers and transformers using the light, the challenge is to make these changes without A, losing ourselves, and B, you know, losing ourselves to hopelessness and despair, and B, without accessing the mechanisms of terror and fear and arguments and war in the transformation process. So if one is to say, I'm going to send, as we do as a country, a bomb over this area of terrorists, whom we've labeled terrorists, then we are engaging in the same terror behavior. And it's important for us to have strategies for engaging in this transformation without becoming the perpetrator of those negative behaviors. So that's my thought today. I have some other things I want to share, but I thought it would be fun to hear from you at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, and we can begin to enlist, you know, this is my strategy, the knowledge and the perspective of the invisible world, those aspects of our being that are in the invisible world, to help us along this path. Hello, you're on the air.
Aspects of our being that are...
Oh, please turn off the radio if you would like to speak on the air. And hello. Yes, hi.
Hi, I didn't expect to get on the air that quickly. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yes, I was quite taken by what you said. I think that world, unfortunately, has gone a little bit further than we wanted it to. I think that what has happened recently is that the prospect of persons having atomic weapons at their easy disposal and working out their relatively petty complaints with those atomic weapons has become imminent. I think there's a tremendous amount of fear throughout the world that now we're no longer facing, you know, the prospect of a Cold War or of disagreement with another nation, but actually annihilation. And I think that, you know, the selfishness has gone away from just my little world and what I can take care of myself and my disdain about the poor to the prospect that, you know, atomic annihilation may be at our doorstep momentarily.
Hmm. Well, I think you're right. This is absolutely one of the fears that most of us hold. And in some ways, it might motivate many of our, you know, our human family to recognize that the petty differences are that. They're just petty differences. And that we can come together as a unified force to transform that potential for Holocaust, global Holocaust. So there is an edge to it that can lead to humanity being in a different place. So I'm hoping that that is the path that we are able to chart for ourselves.
That would be good, except that we've never faced something like ISIS before, where there is a large number of young people who are intent on the prospect of not only self-annihilation, but on global annihilation. And that these people have committed themselves to, you know, worldwide terrorism, and that the atomic bomb is at their doorstep.
Well, yeah, this is a challenge, but I think that also as part of our consideration of this whole issue, whatever ISIS is, I don't know what it is really, in terms of who's really behind it and who really is
would you like to know
fueling it and who really is paying for it, and the realm of beings that are bringing this forth. I can't say that I know entirely what it is. However, I think that we have to be careful not to step into that stew of negativity. You believe that you know who they are?
Sure.
And who is that?
I mean, nearly 1,400 years ago, we had a group of people that became very preeminent in the Middle East, and then they spread their belief system throughout one-third of the known world at the time. And these people were relatively primitive. They lived in a primitive world in which they were not they were not imposed upon in any way, shape, or form. Most recently, the most fundamental group of this has realized that the economic materialism of the world has crept in on their relatively isolated existence and threatened that existence beyond what they ever imagined. So not willing or able to grasp the values of that materialism, they realize that what they can do is they can go towards the religious fundamentalist idea that, well, they're going to have a heaven and they're going to experience nirvana in their heaven, and that the quickest route to that is the annihilation of anything and everything material, including the world itself.
Well, that's... I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. A religion. We have actually, a belief system that the world in which we live is meaningless and futile, and that the world which they can create by destroying that world is a nirvana, is a heaven, is a blissful existence.
Okay. Now, I want you to separate for a minute the actual faith of the Muslim faith. Yeah. And I ask you, is it any different from any staunch fundamentalist religion? That is it not also the fundamentalist Christian religion that holds this belief that they might not call it nirvana, but that the world as we know it is going to be destroyed, and then those of the most faithful are going to rise into some heaven beyond the destruction? So what I'm trying to consider is to pull it out of the realm of pointing at a particular faith and begin to look at the thought process of fundamentalism that is fostering this attitude on both sides. And the reason I say that, because even though you can point at ISIS as arising out of a Muslim faith, potentially, I don't really know, but that's what people say. That's what people believe. But what I'm saying is, in order to rise out of that state of, as you called it, in, you know, sort of a primitive state of existence, there was an infusion of capital and influence, as you said, that also caused perhaps the fundamentalists of the West to sustain and support the fundamentalists of the East, because they all are operating according to a belief system that believes in the destruction of what's happening in our earthly world for some so-called heavenly divine place. So I'm just saying that it's if we pull back from claiming that it's one religion or another and begin to look at it as a mentality, then we can be less in a state of pointing and blaming and naming a particular group of people and begin to look within all of our societies from that state of mind that's causing the furtherance of this ideology. So I was just looking at it from that perspective. And I want to give you more time, but I have a lot of calls coming in. Can I invite you to call back again next time?
Right. Let me leave you with one last thought, though.
Uh-huh.
The conflict of civilizations, let's put it that way. The one civilization, the Western thought, and the other, the say, the Muslim or the Eastern thought, is that the Western thought has now gotten to the point, as it did in not too distant past, where it was facing the crisis of complete desolation, that we faced an economic collapse, which just a few years ago. And unfortunately, that economic collapse has been bolstered only by increased rise in credit, people borrowing.
And it's also being bolstered by increased warring, you know, creating situations of war that help to inflate the so-called dollar. Okay, I got to go on. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, bye-bye. And let's, we have another caller standing by. The number here is 212-209-2900. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
I'm not sure if I left ready the conversation.
I know. It went far afield.
But anyway, no, I wasn't listening. I had the radio off. That's what I meant.
Oh.
I just wanted to say, basically, I think we're probably around the same age. And, you know, because I feel so much like you were explaining how, you know, just that sort of joyous, enthusiastic time in the 60s, basically late 60s, early 70s. But this is what I've been thinking. I think that we just got a taste back then. And maybe it has to do with evolution and astrological forces, energies. But we just got a taste. We were exposed. And I think that now we're in it. I think now we're just moving forward. I don't think there's any turning back like there was before. I don't think that we made, well, you know, maybe it looks like we made mistakes, maybe we did, but it just wasn't really meant to be at that time, you know, ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. I've been thinking that lately, and I also was so thrilled when Occupy Wall Street happened. Oh, my God, that was wonderful. But anyway, that's what I think. I think with maybe, you know, the age of Aquarius and just so many other things. But this time, we're going to do it. We're only moving forward. No turning back.
I entirely agree with you. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay, bye.
Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes.
My name is Malik. I'm from Westchester.
Yes. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Go right ahead.
Well, I was calling because when it comes to religion, I think most people have this preconceived idea about Muslims, and they really don't know really the protocol. What they've seen is people that are violent and call themselves Muslims, and they're not representing anything but their own violence. And if people, you know, really get in depth and really want to know, the people that call themselves Muslims and practice the way of the Prophet, he never promoted wars and conflict. He always promoted peace and getting along with your brothers, no matter what religion they were or whatever, you know, their circumstances are, what they believed in. He never believed in that. He only believed in when somebody aggressed against him. Yes, he defended himself, and and there was wars to defend themselves and on their quest to be free. But when you see all these, this media, which basically I can't even call the corporate media, I can just call it the corporate liars, because they seem to just pull forth these lies, and no one that really authentically knows anything about religion or the following of someone who you're supposed to be in that religion for. You know, if you're going to obey the Creator and do as He says, basically all religions have the same rule. Be good to each other and don't transgress against your anyone.
Exactly, exactly. And this is true. That's, isn't that the meaning of Islam is peace?
Yes, it's submit to the will of the Creator, which is love everyone.
Exactly.
And don't be an aggressor, you know?
Well, see, this is what I was trying to get at, that we're dealing with a distortion that has nothing to do with the core teachings that come through religions. People might choose different religions for different reasons, but this mentality of hostility and war is not the religion. It's something else. And it crosses the boundaries of religion through different religions, through, you know, people who don't follow religions, through various politics. There is an force, an energy that has infiltrated our reality, and it is attempting to destroy what's here. And so I just feel that it's really important for us as human beings to recognize each other as divine, peaceful beings, and begin to ferret out of our consciousness this force that has woven through our consciousness, and in some ways have shaped people to be the embodiment of that, I'll call it, evil consciousness in the world. And so we can't find it by blaming another human being. We find it within ourselves to come to an understanding of what it is and begin to communicate with each other from the level of being human, and in recognition that this energy is here. Does that make any sense? Yeah.
Yes, because people need to understand the energy that they need to be promoting is love. I mean, not just for each other, but for this planet, for every aspect of creation. And when they delve into that and ignore these people that's pushing war and fighting and killing, this is the people that are in control of these governments. All they want is to kill and destroy. And if people just open their eyes and just stop being blinded by this recluse of evil just on a rampage, they would open their eyes and see this and be clear. The clarity would come to you.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that there are many of us who are clear. We're at the stage of trying to figure out what to do about it. How to work through this toxic energy in such a way that it diminishes and the true light of who we are has the room to grow. Thank you for your call. I have a few people standing by. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Okay, let's see. We have two more people on hold. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you are live on the air.
Can I put you off the air, please?
Okay, I'll put you on hold.
Okay, great.
And let's see, in order for me to do that in the meantime, let me play a little bit of music. And that way, we can come to our next caller. Stay tuned. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
My name is Randy. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Randy.
I met you a couple of years ago where the fellow with the that does the eye work. He was a blind fella, and he did the work.
Oh, yeah, the natural eye care stuff?
I remember telling my wife that you had such a powerful aura, but it seemed to me that there was some work that you were trying to discover. And just recently, I spoke with you last week. I was on the line with you and got cut off. And you were you had a gentleman on, and you were talking about this transitional time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that this is a time for the shift in consciousness to create, I guess, a new language around the framework of our experience of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the conditioning that we have suffered for the past eons, and there are a lot of factors for that. Obviously, this isn't the place to get into all of them. Mm-hmm. However, just to crystallize it, the critical mass has come to full circle now. That vibratory energy that brings forth light is now rising to its full potential within humanity. I think your forum that you've even created here, where people are now chiming in all around the world who are listening and who are part of that energy stream, that's all a part of this unfolding. It's mm-hmm. just going to quicken, and I think the results are bearing fruit.
Hmm. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you for doing this, and for all of those people seeking light, there's nothing else to do. It's already here.
There you go. Thank you.
Be blessed.
All right, bye-bye. That was a very lovely comment. There were a few calls that were trying to come in, but I lost you. So if you want to call back, it's 212-209-2900. And it is true. I agree. I totally agree with you, Rick, that the light is indeed here. And it's just a matter of allowing that to grow and expand and flower within. And also it's about healing, helping each other heal, and recognizing in those humans, those fellow passengers on this spaceship Earth, that, yeah, they are perhaps lost in their way. They are perhaps diverted their energies into something that is toxic, but they are indeed our brothers and sisters and can benefit from our healing energies as we go forward. And we also have to be sure that we don't ourselves fall into that state of being lost. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Catherine. It's Noel. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Noel?
Good, good. Yeah, I just wanted to say, you on especially on the first point where we have to differentiate. You know, we can't put people or things or nations or religions into a group. You know, somebody might be Jewish or Christian. It's hard to define that. You know, what does that mean? Because if you look within a group, you've got all kinds of levels and gradients there in the group. You know, so somebody might be a Christian and they might be very fundamentalist, and then somebody might be a Christian or might be a believer in Christ, and yet they're very open to new experiences. You mm-hmm. know, and they're seeking the truth. So I think in all these things, the media and in general wants to put a broad brush on everything. You know, like you talk about many times, I hear the media talk about the black community. Well, what is the black community? Could anybody tell me what the black community is? It's, you know, they want to address it like it's homogenous, you know, like we're all the same, and we're not, you know, and within the black community, I grew up in Queens, you know, and with and it was a very multiracial neighborhood. And, you know, within our community, then you had people who were driven by different things. So rather than looking at some external factor that defines us, I would say, what is it that motivates the person? What is the driving force? What is their passion? What is their passion? That's what defines a person, you know? And then just one other point. We're talking about the light here. We already have the light. The light's in you. The light's in me. The light's in the gentleman who was speaking before. His words were beautiful. He really touched me. Just mm-hmm. Not even just the words, but the vibration. I could feel his heart. And what I'm saying is the light's got to... The light's got to help us out here. You know, like, you know, the greatest miracle to me, all right, is Christ came and Buddha came. They did miracles. That's all fine. The greatest miracle to me would be if we woke up in the morning, looked at our fellow man and honestly said, I love you, I care about you, and I cannot tolerate you suffering any longer.
Yeah.
I have to do something about it. And until that mindset changes, I can't change it for somebody else. You know, we have to do the work on our own, but we need some help from the light.
I agree with you. We each have to do the work on our own, and we do need assistance from the light. We are getting assistance from the light. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, the whole vibrations that are being emanated to the earth from the center of the cosmos, the center of the universe, the central sun. We have traveled into a band of light that is very, very, very high vibrating. And it is what's helping to sustain these changes and helping us as individuals to have our awareness lift into the perspective of our soul and our higher self and the divinity within. So it is making a tremendous difference, but I understand what you mean. We need for someone from the perspective of light with who I would say has the power to maybe disengage all the nuclear weapons, because even if every human being is in that state of enlightened consciousness, you know, there's a lot of toxicity on the earth that just needs to be diffused, disengaged, and eliminated. I'm not sure what that process will be, but that's the kind of help that I could see coming to us from the light. So I want to thank you for your call.
Thanks a lot, dear. Thank you. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Okay, so I am... don't have any callers on hold. One of you were calling, and I had your call on hold so that we can speak between transition. You wanted to speak about something, I believe, regarding one of the pledges. And if you give a call back in 5 minutes, we'll be making the transition to our next program, and I'll be able to take the time to process your call, your question, and problem with your fundraising premium. And again, you're listening to Heart of Mind over WBAI in New York. And I want to invite you to tune in as well on Wednesday evenings at midnight, which is where this program, Heart of Mind, is going to be transitioning into within a month, I would say. And if you start tuning in now, you'll get a sense of that transition, and I will be continuing this conversation at that time. So I will continue to take your calls here at 212-209-2900. Okay, we have time for just one or two calls, and if we can try to be short as we go towards the conclusion of today's show. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to thank you for today's show. I came at the tail end of it, and it was just something that I needed today.
Oh, good.
And I just wondered if I could ask you a quick question about the show that you had with Sharna Flanzer.
Yes.
You were going to have a session on a Saturday. Did you ever have that session?
I believe it took place this past Saturday.
Yeah. Oh, okay, because I was trying to see if I can get into it, and I sent you an email, but maybe just missed that. Okay, will you be having any future ones?
I hope so.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great day. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, let's see. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Welcome.
Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to bring something, you know, you brought up that the Christians believe that, you know, this has to come to an end, and a violent end, and this and that. And the Muslims believe that, I don't know if they believe it or not, but we assume that they have to jihad and fight for this end. And the chosen few, we name unmentioned, or, I don't know, going to be saved by God or something in this little holy land or something like that. This is how it's all playing out here. The three religions are going to battle to the end. And they're all claiming to come in peace, but yet they all claim to be the only way to get to their heavens. But since history hasn't changed, we are due to repeat history. We are following the same scheme, pyramid scheme, of giving untold billions to few people, while the other side of the world suffers miserably for this, and we all buy into it with the 401k, and the Wall Street just keeps ripping us off. So this is nothing new. This has been going on for, this is our way. So we do have to find a new way. It's called evolution. And we can't be doing this any longer because we keep ending up in the same bad spot of, but now it's nuclear. So when the nuclear fallout comes, I don't know if the few can either jump off like a bunch of fleas and stay up in space for a while, maybe even stay on the moon until the radiation settles down, and then come back down or find a rock to hide under. I suggest maybe the oceans we could hide under. But either way, it's not a pleasant scene. But this idea that we could just sit and watch our people, and, you know, making these weapons and selling them behind our backs to, you know, Blackwater and over to ISIS and stuff, and we could just sit here peacefully and nothing's going to happen to us, where we could let half the world starve, and nobody's going to fight us back. And, you know, it's just a silly way of living. And to think that we are such superior beings that we have time to fight each other to the death, to see who's better here on Earth, when we can't even protect ourselves from meteors from space. And if one comes in and hits big enough, it sets off all our nuclear weapons, because it seems like a nuclear strike, and nobody shut the nuclear button, the automatic, you know, fire button off on our... I mean, this is insanity. And we're sitting here talking about it like we have a choice to evolve or not. We don't. We either die or we evolve. So this is where religions are trying to evolve. I mean, look at any species that's been around you more than 10 minutes. They work together. They stop fighting a long time ago when they realize they're not the biggest fish in the sea, that they can be wiped off in a second. But we don't think that. We're proud. We are man. We are the species, the dominant species. But like I said, it's insanity, and it's a beautiful insanity. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's beauty in a lot of the insanity. But for us to keep voting people into power and just giving our power away, to be put to the grindstone so we can't worry about these things, that's another great thing they do to you. You know, you got to get three part-time. You have to go to work 60 hours a week. You get the kids and people. Blah, blah, blah. You're too busy to care about what these other people that we let have all the free time in the world. Because they're godlike. We've made them gods. We will give them billions of dollars. We'll give them our power.
Yeah.
Giving them our power. So, you know, we can sit here and talk all we want, but we better come to a consensus. And the consensus is either, you know, the religious fighting thing is the funniest thing, because all religions are, you know, God is supposed to be a uniting force.
Yeah.
And we split them down the middle in three ways, and it's not going to end well that way. So, I mean, to say that Christianity is a farce, saying that things are not going to end well, but they're going to change eventually afterward, it sounds about right to me. I hate to say it, but it sounds like what's going to happen. Because, you know, unless we really make a move, and I'm talking about the people of the world, I'm not talking about America, because like everybody's into their own country. Like these rich people care about what country they're from. They can go anywhere they want. They don't care. So what I'm saying is, if, you know, we have to defend ourselves against the mindset of other people that just want to take a BBB and go hide somewhere and win.
So exactly.
That's the game you want to play. I mean, I'm all for it, but it's not going to have a happy ending for the majority of us, and it may not have to have any ending for any of us. So, I mean, we've been here before. We've done this before.
This is not the first civilization that would have destroyed itself. I happen to believe we've reached the other side of that destruction. But we have to learn, like you said, evolve without turning into that destructive force. And we'll be talking about that more as we go forward. Thank you. I am going to say goodbye for now. Stay tuned. Coming up in just a moment will be a program by Paulette Spencer created for International Working Women's Day. And we hope you do enjoy that. You're tuned to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight with Catherine Davis and Paulette Spencer.
Hello, this is Paulette Spencer for Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight on Pacifica Radio Network, WBAI in New York. Today, in honor of International Working Women's Day, we are honored to interview two persons from the International Women's Rights Organization, AFRM, Ms. Patricia Gonzalez and Ms. Jocelyn Cower. And we will be discussing the policies supported by presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton and their effects on women of color. Welcome, Patricia and Jocelyn. Please tell us about the work that your organization does.
So AFRM stands for the Association of Filipinas Feminists Fighting Imperialism, Refugeeization, and Marginalization. And it's a national organization of women that launched in 2010, engaged in transnational feminist and anti-imperialist activism. And we have a diverse, multi-ethnic membership committed to movement building from this country through grassroots organizing, trans-ethnic alliance building, education, advocacy, and direct action. And we also have chapters around the country, mainly in Boston, in various areas in California and here in New York City. And its previous formation was called Gabriela Network, and we used to engage in work from a national democratic perspective and used to emphasize support and solidarity for the Philippine movement. But after an assessment of our previous work and continued engagement with the struggles and issues of women in our communities in the United States, we have moved toward a comprehensive theory building and practice based on the concrete conditions of our own communities in this country.
We're going to be discussing the policy support of presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in regard to her work concerning women of color in the United States, in Honduras, and in Haiti. And the reasons I chose this is because I think her past, in terms of the positive things she's endorsed, in terms of the perhaps more controversial policy she's endorsed, is really worth examining. And so my first question is, what have been the positive effects of policies supported by Hillary Clinton on women of color in the United States and their loved ones?
I wanted to talk about the policies like the Second Chance Act that she has endorsed and supported, which is a law that was put into place in around 2007-2008. It was trying to reduce recidivism to give these former prisoners a second chance to reintegrate into society and to find a way that can help
talking about the generally positive turn of events where they can improve their lives after they've been incarcerated or jailed and they finally lost detention. So since 2009, we've found that the Office of Juvenile Justice has awarded hundreds of grants to those who have done their time. And this policy in place that offers monetary grants and social services that Hillary has supported really addresses the needs of people leaving detention facilities financially. It addresses many issues that they might face, especially towards marginalized groups such as people of color, women of color, and especially the indigenous and Native American demographic, since they are also eligible for these grants. Having this kind of support for these marginalized groups is especially important because they disproportionately lack these kinds of services. But what the grants do provide is, you know, mentoring services, substance abuse treatment, family planning, which could even be specific for women of color who might also be mothers and have had to experience motherhood within these detentions. You might have personal finance resources. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have come back home with the ability to reintegrate into society because of these programs. And I think these are wonderful positive effects that Hillary Clinton has had by supporting the Second Chance Act. And, you know, it was signed years ago, almost 9, 10 years ago, but I think it was a crucial step forward for its time in addressing the problematic incarceration of people of color, and in particular because of the three strikes law and the general mass incarceration that we see happening in today's society.
What have been the negative effects on women of color in regard to her policies? I'm thinking of the fact that perhaps, as you just mentioned, this law to reduce recidivism might have been in reaction to her husband's three strikes law that came out in 1994. What do you make of that?
Today, because of the spikes of incarceration of people of color and specifically of women of color. So I wonder about the effectiveness of the Second Chance Law, because, you know, it did help to tackle recidivism and making sure that we don't have people coming back to these prison complexes, but perhaps it didn't really address the reasons why people of color and women of color were sentenced to prison in the first place. Many of the, you know, quote-unquote strikes that offenders would receive would be for nonviolent crimes or these minor drug offenses. And we see that these undeniably hurt people of color who were unfairly striked. So then we must wonder, we have this larger, longer prison sentences on repeat offenders who truthfully did not commit very violent crimes to begin with. And, you know, although our people of color may be a minority in a certain state, somehow, because of three strikes law, they then become a majority in the prison complex. So then, CIRM has been in discussion about this many times, where we stand for the Black Lives Matter movement and the Say Her Name campaign, which fight against the indifferent, imbalanced prosecution of women of color and people of color. So we will speak the names of women like Kendra Chapman and Sandra Bland, who were in detention for minor offenses and unfortunately never saw justice.
And what would you make of the 1996 Personal Responsibility and Work Reconciliation Act, also known as the Welfare Reform Act, in terms of its effect on women of color?
The Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, it was an act that was heavily campaigned by the Clinton administration in the 90s, and Hillary considered it one of the highlights / accomplishments of Bill's presidency, which sought to, quote, unquote, end welfare as we know it. And the federal act wanted to basically reduce rates of dependency of mostly single mothers on public assistance. But the federal act didn't take into account the rise of low-wage work and the disappearance of the manufacturing jobs that were being outsourced to China, Mexico, India, India, Vietnam, and Malaysia, thanks to NAFTA. And, of course, a lot of working women would have wanted to stop depending on a system that stigmatized them more than helped them. So she's basically doing a campaign right now of saying that she's, you know, she's behind women of color, that she is supporting Black Lives Matter, but her actions do not reflect that. It's very worrisome that a lot of young people, actually even black people in this country are supporting her candidacy. And it's amazing because this act actually gave states the right to choose whether they were going to fund public assistance programs or not. So it was detrimental to working class people, and especially working class women, single mothers and their children.
And if we move the time frame up in terms of policies that she has supported, I'm thinking of policies President Barack Obama, specifically the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, which permits the current administration to put into prison without any trial American citizens based on a suspicion of activities that are detrimental to U.S. security. How do you think that affects women of color and the people they love?
The implications for the indefinite detention clause in the NDAA are seriously just staggering. That Obama would include an indefinite detention clause in this budget packet for this act is largely problematic and controversial. And to have this act that lacks and takes away the right to due process really leads the American people to wonder how institutions can deprive people of their constitutional rights. We're looking at mostly people of color and especially women of color who are already at the margins, but if somehow racially profiled or suspected of terrorist activity, their rights have already been deprived, and by not including their right to due process, deprives their right even further. This act even increases the militarization of the state to detain any, you know, quote-unquote suspicious individual, whether American or not, with military aid. And so increasing this military influence on just an individual, especially a woman of color, allows the U.S. to wield this large military power. And, you know, looking at Obama and Clinton as this foreign policy duo, yet they've been well received by the general public, but this particular clause is an odd kind of anomaly. That the U.S. federal government is even funding this has a lot of negative effects, including the upkeep of Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which we see a very large person of color population there, and it perpetuates this fear-mongering tactic that we see many officials or political individuals using, which is incredibly problematic. So as Patricia had stated earlier, you know, we need to look at our presidential candidates and how they view terrorism and how this terrorist profiling and indefinite detention can be harmful to U.S. foreign policy today.
I'd like to move on to a discussion about the Central American country of Honduras. Recently, I guess as recent as 2009, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, openly supported the ouster of the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. His term was from 2006 to 2009, and he was a member of the Liberty Party of Honduras. And my question is, how has the support of such an ouster affected the lives of women in Honduras?
Well, as soon as former President Manuel Zelaya was ousted from power, there was an increase in drug cartels and gangs, and basically there was a instability that had existed in the 80s once again, and also there was violence against women's rights on the street and when seeking birth control. So Zelaya was in favor of the pill, having illegal abortion. And also, there was a total reversal of protection of the LGBTQ population in the country that has resulted in the death of LGBTQ activists and ordinary citizens. And the homicide rate in Honduras, already at the highest in the world, has increased by 50% from 2008 until 2011. And political repression, the murder of opposition political candidates, peasant organizers, and LGBTQ activists. And also, femicides have skyrocketed. So basically, complete insecurity. It's chaotic there in Honduras. And with the recent assassination of environmental activist Berta Cáceres, this is very, very palpable, especially for people who are trying really, like, with their older might, with all their sweat and their tears, to stop government forces from appropriating the land, appropriating the rivers, the water. And it's really devastating that the Honduran government did not take the necessary measures to protect her or other people that have already passed as well. And I mean, it's very clear that the gangs are also trying to get kids to join them, and kids in refusal, so they don't die, they decide to walk those miles through Mexico, and then they get here, and then they're told that you have to go back, or you have to prove your case, when they have nowhere else to go. I mean, it's really amazing, it's to say the least, that how Hillary Clinton has promoted this idea that everybody is due process, but the due process is actually biased in the against them.
That's pretty powerful, and I think it's interesting that when we talk about women of color and the people who they love, at least the way I'm using that term is their brothers, their uncles, their husbands, their sons, and that a woman's entire social network is put at risk by some of these policies. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
I would like to move on now to the island nation of Haiti. And recently, Haiti has attempted to have their elections. Up until now, we've seen the presidency of President Martelly. And I'm looking back at the events of January 2010, where Haiti suffered a fairly significant earthquake that demolished much of the island's shelters and left the citizens of that country living in even more dire conditions than they were before the earthquake. And my question is, as Secretary of State, how has Hillary Clinton positively affected the lives of women in this post-earthquake state of the nation of Haiti?
So post-disaster relief is always a crucial part in rebuilding and redeveloping a nation, and the earthquake in Haiti was no exception. I mean, it was certainly an exceptionally devastating. The Clinton Foundation itself has tried to empower young girls and women, and people see her as this champion for women's rights, to challenge these girls to break the glass ceiling, so to speak. But I find that her championing for women's rights in Haiti was largely a business venture. She supported small businesses through relief funds, and the Clinton Foundation raised plenty of money, and Hillary Clinton herself, as Secretary of State, raised plenty of awareness campaigns for disaster relief within Haiti, and of course she focused on environmental issues, education, which always matters most to young women, especially after a natural disaster, but the focus on business investment, industry, and energy are already fields that are largely male-dominated. So I think her campaigns on Haiti really fell short on actual implementation. She had spoken very often on this topic. She had posted campaigns online, but, you know, Haitian women have largely voiced distrust in what tangible changes she actually made in Haiti. They do not feel that grassroots on the ground work was actually achieved when they needed it the most. So her focus on business ventures in an already male-dominated field, you know, further pushed and relegated these women to the margins yet again where they already were. And even public sentiment for Martelli was already quite low. Hillary Clinton has already shaken hands with Martelli, trusting that he would rebuild Haiti post-earthquake, but, you know, posting a laundry list for things that we would like Martelli to achieve was largely unsuccessful. Haiti already has no successors to its president since Martelli had left in February, so we need to consider what the state of women will look like in the future. We don't want these women to be forgotten since they already bear the burden the most of post-disaster conflict, and women themselves have already distrusted Martelli during his presidency. He was openly sexist and openly told women that they need to go get a man, implying that their livelihood is defined by men to begin with. So I think it's important that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, may have championed and worked towards justice for women and making sure that they have the resources they need post-disaster at the earthquake, but we also need to be critical of what tangible changes she's actually made, if at all.
What has been the role of the Clinton Foundation in the reconstruction of Haiti?
The director of the Clinton Foundation's Haiti program, his name is Greg Milne, and he said that projects include efforts that have helped more than 2,000 small farmers, an artisan goods company that employs more than 300 people, a fish farming operation, a cholera treatment center, and improvements to schools in some of Haiti's poorest slums. And also the Clinton Foundation has spent more than $30 million in Haiti and led efforts through the Clinton Global Initiative to persuade private companies to spend vastly more in the country. And one more thing, the Clinton Foundation united forces with Dennis O'Brien, an Irish telecom billionaire who has contributed millions to the foundation, and he has opened his own Marriott hotel, and he employs local people. Of course, this is a positive, seemingly positive outcome of the Clinton Foundation's investment in the country. The hotel is filled with locally purchased art, and it serves food from the country. And he also leads the Haiti Action Network, a collection of private businesses that have committed through the Clinton Global Initiative to spend $500 million on projects in Haiti. And lastly, he and his company just built 150 schools and rebuilt Port au Prince's historic iron market. These are seemingly positive things, but again, it's investment is going to fix something something such as broodedness and lack of education, mass lack of resources to education, I mean to say. It's just a band-aid, once again. It's a band-aid to something that needs to change through just more organizing and politicians who actually care about their population. So it's also very sad to hear how people are just looking for a job at a company, for example. I mean, it's a positive thing that she has invested a lot in this country, but it's not the fact that she has set up more garment companies that help Target, Gap, and Walmart. I mean, it's just not, it just keeps putting women, poor women of color at the bottom of society with meager wages, slave-like conditions, and it's a generational issue that it's never gonna end. What is the solution? Everybody should have access to fair wages, not just Americans. And even for Americans, she doesn't even advocate, you know.
It seems as if the wording of the descriptions of their investments really mask their intentions of, rather than building the capacity of the country, they are actually just simply working for themselves.
Exactly.
And one of the startling revelations that I guess has been in the news since the earthquake is that for all of the money that's been invested, so much of the population are still living in tents, which is essentially the emergency housing they had to create immediately after the earthquake. So the question is, for all of the cash that's been coming in, we don't necessarily see beyond the hotels where that money has actually been spent.
Countries donate to governments, I'm saying, they donate to her foundation, and so much money that is mismanaged. And it's one more thing about Hillary Clinton and her younger brother, Tony Rodham, was actually serving on the advisory board of a U.S.-based company that in 2012 won one of Haiti's first two gold mining permits in 50 years. And after objection from the Haitian Senate, the permits have been placed, were placed on hold. It's this idea that keeps, the idea that free trade is going to solve everything for us. But the forces of racism, sexism, and capitalism just are much stronger than free, actually capitalism is included in free trade. These forces are much stronger than the willingness of people to take a population to the next level of development.
Well, on that note, I'm thank you very much for participating in this interview, and I want you to please let the audience know how they can follow your organization's work.
Yes, so we are on affirm.org, so it's actually spelled AF3IRM.org, and we have chapters in Boston and in many areas in California and in New York City. Let's talk about women. At the end of the day, we are very we're at a disadvantage in so many ways, but we're also powerful if we get together.
Thank you again for agreeing to have this interview. I am Paulette Spencer, and this has been Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight, on International Working Women's Day, March 8th, 2016.
In the room. load too big to carry. Yeah, come to the river where the healing waters flow. There will be mountains to climb and valleys dark as the night, and roads you have never known. Follow the answers to the questions in your soul, down by the water where the river gates control. Ooh, 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 yeah, yeah.
You on recording. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI, streaming over WBAI.org. Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, an allegedly weekly program regarding science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund, and we're going to catch up on some movie reviews, and then our guest reported about a week ago, Lawrence M. Shum. Stay tuned. Once again, good morning. So, yeah, it's been like a month and a half since I have been able to address you. I was scheduled for a three-hour special to kick off the fundraising drive, and of course it would turn out that I was sick. I was really sick. I was nose-dripping, soppingly, yucky, blah, sick, and just could not do it. And it was also a little difficult because I didn't have a lot of notice that I was going to have that wonderful opportunity. I was hoping to actually get something toward the end of the drive so that I could tie into the sad 10th anniversary of the passing of Olivia Butler. But we are going to Octavia Butler. What am I doing, Olivia? For God's sake, what world am I living in? One in which hopefully Junie Butler would still be alive, but alas, it's been 10 years. And I was one of the last people to interview her, and it was quite shocking and a horrible thing. And something that we will get into ere long with some special guests. So it won't be exactly the 10th anniversary, but it's something that we're going to deal with. And then, for the other 4 weeks, should have been 4 weeks total, but it turned out to be 5 Wednesdays during which the fundraising drive occurred, I was simply preempted, plain and simple. So, what can I say other than, hello, we're back. And in that time, I have not been lackadaisical. I've recorded several interviews. The one that we're going to hear this week, I'll intro in a little while. And next week, unless something should happen that I do a live show, which, you know, a live guest could occur, Lev Grossman will be the guest. But in that same time, Dan Persons was not slack on movie reviews, and I'm afraid that the two that we have are a bit out of date. However, they are both still playing, and, you know, it's always interesting, even if it's a movie that you're not going to race out and see. I like reading reviews, even of films that I am not ready to race for. And although these are both very interesting, Kung Fu Panda 3, and I found 1 and 2 to be amazingly decent. And then The Witch, which is a movie by the title of which, if you will allow, I wouldn't go see, except that it sounds utterly fascinating, and it's not gory. It's, yes, it's frightening. Yes, it's got fear and terror in it, but it is not what it sounds like. It's not necessarily even technically really genre. But why don't we listen to the two reviews that Dan Persons had for us in February, and hopefully as of next week, we'll be back on the horse. Dan, if you're listening, I'd love to hear also what you have to say about Zootopia, which has gotten shockingly good reviews. Anyhow, here are two that we've missed.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It appears that somebody involved with Kung Fu Panda 3 took a look at Po, the titular Kung Fu Panda, voiced by Jack Black, and said, "You know, he doesn't really act like a panda." This has led to a good chunk of the second sequel focusing on how the supposedly last of the pandas discovers he's actually nowhere near the last, first reuniting with his father, voiced by Bryan Cranston, then returning to an isolated mountain village to discover a whole flock of anthropomorphized pandas behaving more in ways you'd expect anthropomorphized pandas to behave. They're cute, they're playful, they're fun-loving, they roll a lot, they eat a lot. They're Ewoks, essentially, and, well, I never had as much problem with Ewoks as many did, but if you're terminally allergic to the furry little cash grabs, these larger, roly-polier versions, however more convincing they are than costumed little people, probably won't sit well. Beyond that, there's another problem. Po was never a real panda to begin with, any more than Bugs Bunny acts like a genuine rabbit or Fred Flintstone acts like an actual caveman. So why start now? The movie struggles with this, creating some malarkey about how Po now has to discover his true nature, which even the characters in the film are confused by, since the previous two installments were also about Po discovering its true nature. Apparently, this is another true nature. If the franchise ever gets to Kung Fu Panda 4, maybe there'll be one more true nature for him to discover. Panda's going to be less in need of Kung Fu training than therapy after all of this, I think. There could have been something to this. In a more sophisticated treatment, this could have been an exploration of the tensions between personal identity, racial identity, and assimilation, since the bad guy here, a reincarnated yak spirit named General Kai, voiced by J.K. Simmons, is going around absorbing warrior chi and the warriors themselves into his own form. That issue could have resonated all the way through to the film's central conflict. The filmmakers either didn't bother taking advantage of the opportunity, or it somehow got lost in the rewrites. To their credit, the Panda Tribe is way funnier than the Ewoks ever were, and directors Jennifer Yeh, who also helmed the much better Kung Fu Panda 2, and Alessandro Carloni keep the visuals dazzling and the action inventive. If the previous Kung Fu Panda leaned heavily on Jackie Chan-style martial arts comedy, Part 3 is all about Joy Hark-style epic action fantasy, complete with a battle finale set in a crazily surreal otherworld. The Kung Fu Panda franchise has been DreamWorks' showcase for CG animation and impressive 3D filmmaking, and Kung Fu Panda 3 at least lives up to that reputation. It's great to watch, it's entertaining, it's exciting, it's just not so much to think about. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com. Hour of the Wolf movie review.